This week on the show, we get ready for basketball season with Jared Weiss of USA Today. Adam Jones of 98.5 The Sports Hub breaks down yesterday's Patriots nail-biting win. And what are the Red Sox going to look to do this offseason? All that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Welcome to Calling It, Monday, October 16th, 2017. Alex Barth, Alex Lebowitz, getting ready today for the Boston Celtics season. Finally around the corner, the Celtics tip off on Tuesday against the Cleveland Cavaliers. Here to break it down and take a look at what we can expect from the Celtics through this first stretch of the season is Jared Weiss. Jared, how you doing?
I am doing well. It's great to be the first week of the NBA season.
Yeah, with all the anticipation, everything we've been through this offseason, when's the last time there's this much hype, not just for the Celtics, but league-wide, for the season to start?
Jeez, I don't know. I mean, the funny thing is Mark Stein, who's now with the New York Times, wrote this really cool article that just came out where it's basically the league has gone absolutely insane. So much has happened, and it's all pointless because the Warriors are still the Warriors and are probably even better than last year. So, you know, nothing gets people more excited for the NBA than off-season trades when big stars move. You know, people, they have the video game and fantasy league mindset where they're more interested in the transactions and the big stories than the actual games themselves. So, like, we're in hyperdrive for that. I mean, we had movement that was unprecedented this year. We had 7 superstars move. So I think everyone is just super excited to see all these new teams because they don't know what to expect. And I think these new teams are so, they change in ways that make it very hard to predict what they're going to look like, especially the Celtics. But I'm just really excited to see how they all get their asses kicked by Golden State.
We're talking to Jared Weiss of the Celtics Wire at USA Today and CLNS Media. I guess the big question right now, tomorrow night, me and Lebowitz will touch on this in a bit for those of you listening, but Jared, we want your take. Is LeBron James going to play? And if he doesn't, what does that say about the current state of the Cavs?
I mean, my take is his leg has to be broken for him to not play and Kyrie's return to Cleveland. So I would be shocked if he doesn't play. I would expect him, if he's actually hurt, he would play in this game and then take like a week or two off. Like, this game is huge for him. We all know how LeBron, how he utilizes the media, how he utilizes the spotlight. So this one's a big one for him. So they're going to have to yank him off the floor with a medical, you know, pass for him to not play in this one. And then, I mean, it's got to be insane. Like, this game, there's opening night games between competitors, and then there's one where the teams made a massive trade with each other that was extremely controversial. This is like unprecedented stuff here. Like, I can't believe that this is our opening night slate. Like, everyone that loves the NBA got really lucky with this one, that everything fell into place to make this game just like the ultimate soap opera debut. So it's going to be incredible.
So in regard to Cleveland, is this another season where they're going to be the 2 seed to the Celtics? And also, a couple days ago, J.R. Smith had some comments. He's upset that D-Wade's starting over him. Do you see that locker room controversy kind of carrying over into this season right now with what we've seen?
I don't think so. I mean, for one, they're probably all going to finish 3rd to the Wizards. So
of course,
I don't think
naturally.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think the Celtics are going to improve with their win total this year. I think they might regress a little bit. Frankly, their win total last year was above what you would expect from their point differential. So they kind of overachieved last year thanks to Isaiah Thomas having one of the all-time great clutch seasons. So I don't expect them to pull that off again this year, even though I think they'll be better by the end of the season than they were last year. Cleveland, I mean, you know, I feel like they're probably deeper skill-wise than they were last year. They've improved in that regard. I mean, if Rose is good, then they can survive having Thomas hurt. But, you know, the difference between Kyrie Irving versus Derrick Rose is, you know, it's not even a comparison. So until Isaiah comes back and has a few months under him, which hopefully happens, obviously we hope for the best for Isaiah, you know, the Cleveland's not going to be great either. They're going to be kind of a shell of what they can become and the team that they can be that would be a finals competitor. So, you know, both of these teams, both the Celtics and the Cavaliers, I think have some factors that indicate that they're not going to be quite as good as they were last year. But at the same time, I feel like Cleveland underachieved in the regular season as much as they could. So, you know, for them, just barely cracking 50 wins last year was like, that was an achievement in mediocrity and a lack of effort for them last. LeBron's teams in Cleveland have traditionally won in the low to mid 50s win totals, so I don't expect that to change too much. But they should be neck and neck for that first seed, and I do think Washington and maybe Toronto will be up in that range as well. And if everything goes right from Milwaukee, I mean, we could see them up there if Jabari Parker is able to get back and be healthy early on.
And for the Celtics, just looking at what the Celtics have coming up here, the speculative opening lineup, I think, has been released. I think speculative would be the term. What people think it's going to be without Marcus Morris, it looks like Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum are both going to start opening night against Cleveland. And for the opening stretch of the season, these are two young kids you're throwing right into the fire. How many minutes do you expect Brad to give them in the early going? Are they going to be as big of a factor as some people think?
Well, I mean, Steven said that's what he thinks the lineup's going to be. So, speculative is not strong enough. Like, it looks like this is the projected starting lineup.
That's the word I was looking for. I didn't think of projected, so I went with speculative. Thank you.
Yeah, but yeah, good enough, whatever. So, I mean, Jaylen, we know, is already, like, one of their key guys. So he's going to be playing 30 minutes at least. Tatum, we'll see. I mean, he's starting. He's going to be facing LeBron probably a decent amount because they're going to be switching every screen. So he's going to – assuming LeBron plays, a big part of Cleveland's game plan will be to try to run ball screens with LeBron to get Tatum switched onto him, and then LeBron's going to try to clear him out and attack him and so forth. Tatum, one of the things – like, I've been really, really impressed with Tatum so far, and I think one of the things that's impressed me the most about him is his defensive footwork and awareness and balance has been way better than I would have expected, especially because he wasn't that good defensively at Duke. He's made so many strides just over the last 3 months or so working with the team. He's gone from being a person that was considered to be not that effective of a defender in college to someone who is good enough at defense that he's starting as a rookie on a contending team. Over a few guys, frankly, that I think could be, like, for instance, Marcus Smart, they could easily, especially against Cleveland, who's starting both Derrick Rose and Dwayne Wade, they could easily start Marcus Smart and not worry about the fact that he gives up 5 inches compared to Tatum. But frankly, you know, Marcus Smart plays like a 7-footer anyway with the intensity and the power that he has. So it is a bold vote of confidence that Stevens is making here in Tatum by putting him in the starting lineup against Cleveland. And it certainly says that Stevens is confident in Tatum's mental makeup, that he's not going to be rattled by this situation. And Tatum is a very quiet, very steady and level-headed guy. I mean, I only have so much track record to base this on and just interacting with him during the preseason, but we'll see what happens over the course of 20 games in the regular season and when he faces adversity, what happens. But, I mean, this guy is doing things that are pretty rare for a rookie, and especially for a rookie that's being thrown into a situation like this where he's going up against LeBron James and Giannis Antetokounmpo in his first two nights in the NBA. I mean, it's going to be – if there's such thing as a rude awakening, that is the rudest awakening you could imagine.
And we're talking to Jared Weiss of USA Today and CLNS Media. Jared, what are the odds that Tatum surpasses Jaylen Brown this year in minutes?
I think they'll be comparable. I mean, Brown, there's not much he can do to lose opportunity here. I mean, he serves a very important role on this team where he is probably their most versatile defender along with Marcus Smart. And I think he's competent enough offensively at this point that I don't think they're going to be needing to take him off the floor because there's an offensive liability. So he's a good, he's like a pretty solid two-way player already. And he doesn't need, like, a lot of his weaknesses, I think, are things that won't come into play when he's playing with the starting lineup. So, like, his ability to create off the bounce, for instance, he has trouble with his ball handling where he turns it over a lot. He has some trouble with, like, decision-making when he's handling the ball. But those are things that he's not going to do a ton of. You know, most of the time, if he's handling the ball, it's kind of in the same way for Tatum, where he is catching the ball for a spot-up, and then he's dribbling off of a closeout by the defender and things along those lines. So I don't think it's going to come into play for him too much where, like, he's going to be making enough mistakes for him to have to be taken off the floor. So the opportunity for Jalen to make mistakes is very much mitigated by him being in the lineup with Horford and Hayward and Kyrie. So things are going to be pretty easy for him. You know, it's like Danny Ainge said, and I think it was on the Bob Ryan podcast, how when he first got to the league, and he was shocked by how easy things were for him because he was no longer getting triple teamed by everybody like he was at BYU. And I think Jalen is probably enjoying the same thing, where when he was at Cal 2 years ago, he was playing in a system where there was no spacing because they had two centers on the floor and he had no room to create. Now he's like the fifth most important offensive player on the floor. So like he has a lot of free range to basically do whatever he wants with these easy opportunities that he gets. So he's in a pretty good situation. I think he's turning into a very, very good on-ball defensive player, and he's learning help defense. So he's going to be a tremendous defender sometime soon down the road. And he's going to have to be for them early on because he's probably going to be covering LeBron maybe more than anybody else in the lineup.
In regard to Tatum, will he have enough of an impact on this year's Celtics team to be a legitimate Rookie of the Year contender, or is it really between Fultz or Lonzo Ball?
Well, it sure is telling between Fultz right now because he's not starting for Philly open the year. Yeah. So you can write that off for now. I mean, Lonzo, DSJ, and Fox are like the three favorites as far as I'm concerned. Those guys are all going to be handling the ball, putting up numbers on teams where like they really desperately need them to score points and get assists. So like the counting stats are going to be good for those guys. Tatum could be right there because if he's starting on a finals contender, it's like what other rookie can you think of that has that besides Jaylen Brown actually last year? Jaylen was mostly by necessity because they wanted to keep Smart with the second unit because they needed him to help keep the second unit afloat because they had no other creators. And Avery Bradley was hurt, and that's when Jalen was starting. Tatum is starting by choice. Now, maybe Morris will be starting once he gets healthy, and he's going to be out for, it looks like, a week with the right knee soreness, which he's been dealing with throughout the preseason. So this could just be a stopgap, but it's also their end goal. You know, they drafted Tatum, they drafted Brown, they put together their – we won't call them a big three, but we'll call them their three all-stars. They put that whole thing together with the idea of we're going to run these lineups where we have a big that can guard anybody and is one of the best facilitators of his generation at his position. Three wings that can do pretty much everything on the floor and can switch everything. And then an elite scoring point guard. And the end goal was for Jalen to be the starting, it's not even a position. It's starting wing Jalen, starting wing Gordon, starting wing Tatum. That's the long-term out. That's the outlook for this team. That's the lineup that they can put together that could beat Cleveland and Golden State in theory because every single person in those lineups can go up against LeBron except for Kyrie, obviously. But, you know, if they put Marcus at the one instead of Kyrie, which they're not going to do, obviously, in crunch time because they need Kyrie out there. But, like, you know, those teams defensively, everyone can guard everyone. And that's the one way that you're able to overcome the vulnerabilities that teams like Cleveland and Golden State create in opposing defenses. So it's a great concept, and it's a great kind of zig to the zag of what everyone else has been doing. And they've been generally ahead of the league on this one. And the fact that they're going with it on opening night is a huge vote of confidence to Tatum and a huge vote of confidence to the fact that they think that this program that they put together is really viable, and they want to really develop it throughout the year because they think they could have a chance to get to the finals this year.
Jared, you mentioned Marcus Smart a couple of times. The discussion the last week or so has been, will he, won't he get an extension? It's not, according to Adam Kaufman of WBZAM in Boston. The sides talked about an extension, but they're not going to go into the season with one. Who is taking a bigger risk here with Marcus Smart not being signed throughout the season? Is it the Celtics or is it Smart himself?
It's pretty interesting. I didn't see Kaufman saying that they don't expect to get it done, but I don't expect them to get it done because
it may have been Kaufman saying he didn't expect to get it done. It may have been that.
So I'll just say no disrespect at all to Adam, but like that should be just his opinion. And frankly, I don't think either side knows that they're going to be able to get anything done. I think Boston, their number is probably 14. I think if they can get Marcus for 4 years at 14 per year, that's the kind of investment that they would say that's a big investment, but that's a reasonable investment for us to pay our sixth man. And they're going to cross the tax threshold probably next year, and they're going to be stuck there for a long time. So this is their one chance to lock in a, a good player like Marcus, because they're going to have to pay Tatum way down the road and Jaylen pretty soon down the road. And, you know, it's worth paying a pretty big luxury tax bill to keep the starting five that they have now and Marcus Smart, because that's a core that can be a championship contender for like a decade. That's a core that can try to topple LeBron and make a good run at Golden State, especially in a couple years where if Jaylen and Tatum really do develop. So I think they should do that deal. But on the other hand, Marcus Smart and his agent, Happy Walters, are looking at the deal that Gary Harris just signed in Denver, where he's making up to like $20.5 million a year. And they're thinking, I think I'm just as good as Gary Harris. I'm one of the elite defenders in the NBA. I'm putting together a pretty comprehensive offensive game now. I'm hitting my shots in the preseason. He shot 7-for-12 from three in the preseason. So Marcus is thinking, I'm not taking anything short of, you know, at least 18 or 19 million, which the Celtics are definitely not going to agree to at this point. And he's thinking, I'm going to bet on myself. I'm going to play out the year. I'll have restricted free agency so I can get an offer sheet and the Celtics will match, most likely. The problem for him is that there's not a lot of teams with cap space out there. Right now, there's only projected to be like six or seven teams with like max cap space, cap space of like $30+ million. The offer sheet at that substantial level might not be there for Marcus. So he's taking a big bet. But based on what we've seen in the preseason, if he plays that way during the regular season, he's going to get a much bigger offer sheet than whatever offer he's getting from Ainge right now. So I think it makes the most sense for both sides not to agree to a deal right now.
Is this Celtics roster set? Is this the team that we are going to see throughout the next 5 years? It seems like that's the consensus. Or could you see them somehow making another deal, Danny Ainge, thinking that there's something missing, maybe this season or next offseason?
And let me just throw on top of that real quick. Shorter picture, they do still have that one roster spot. Is there anybody you think they could add in the short term via free agency, Kendrick Perkins, Richard Jefferson, before this thing gets really underway?
Well, it sounds like Perk is already going to be a coach in the next couple weeks, so I don't think it's going to be. It wouldn't even be Perk. Perk's not the kind of player that they need right now, and I say that as someone who covers a team, and Perk is one of my favorite people in the world, and I would love to have him back here just so I could talk to him before the games. And same thing for RJ. Those are two of my favorite people I've ever met in my entire life. I love those guys. So I really hope that they do sign with the Celtics. That being said, I don't think either of those guys are going to sign. You know, one interesting – so, like, it makes sense for them to want to get someone who is 7-foot-ish, who they just know can affect shots, so they at least have the option of throwing that person in there. You know, it makes sense for them not to spend money on someone in your core rotation that you think of as just like a interior shot blocker. You know, they went with Aaron Baines, who is not that good of a shot blocker or shot effector in the post, but is a smart defender and a hard-nosed guy that gives you that kind of mentality down low. They gave their room of exception to him, which I thought was a smart move, and I like what I've seen from him so far. It makes more sense if you want to have a 7-footer that you know can at least contest shots, use your 15th roster spot for that, sign him to a veteran minimum, because you're not going to use them a ton, especially because their defensive system doesn't really call for that kind of player. So it makes sense for them to try to find someone here. Right now, I can't think of anybody on the open market that is like a clear pick for that kind of role. They did sign someone who kind of fits that bill in Daniel Okafu, but I reported the other day that he's going to be waived and sent down to Maine. I haven't heard that he's been waived yet. They might just be waiting to waive him until they know who they're going to fill that last roster spot with. But, you know, and of course things could change. But that's what I was told from someone who absolutely would know what the plan is there. So I'm confident that's going to be happening within the next day or two. You know, and then there's one, so like all the cuts are happening today. Today's a deadline for everybody to make their cuts. One really interesting one that happened is in Memphis, Wade Baldwin, who was a first round pick a year ago, he somehow ended up getting cut. And I think they kept Mario Chalmers over him, which was really surprising. And he's kind of like a poor man's Avery Bradley. He has a lot of defensive potential. He can defend probably any position, one through at least two and maybe even three. His offensive game is extremely raw, but there is potential for him to be a decent ball handler in the future. But he's someone that would also make a lot of sense, because it's going to be hard for them to pick up guys that are high upside guys in the near future. And, you know, while if I'm Wade Baldwin, I would much rather go to a bad team where I can actually get an opportunity, like Atlanta, for instance. It would be interesting for the Celtics to at least offer him the Bette Midler and see if he's interested.
All right, he is Jared Weiss. You can read him on USA Today, hear him on the Celtics Wire, and on CLNS Media. Jared, thanks for taking the time and enjoy the game tomorrow.
My pleasure, boys.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth, Alex Lovitz. We're now joined on the phone by 98.5 The Sports Hub's Adam Jones. We get ready to talk some Patriots, recap that oh-too-close game yesterday, and take a look ahead to what may be the biggest game of the year. Jones, how are you doing?
What's up, guys? How are you? I think I'm doing better than the Patriots defense anyways.
I think we all are, although I will say they only allowed 17 points. Belichick's never been about the yards against. He's been about the points against. I want to start here, though, because this is what everybody's talking about today. It was 17 points. It could have been more. Jones, the Austin Seferian Jenkins fumble, in air quotes, what did you think of that call?
Yeah, look, I've read the rule. I've seen the replays. I've heard the explanation from Al Riveron and read the pool report and everything yesterday from Tony Corrente. And I still don't see how you overturned that call in that game yesterday. Now, you know, I'm not saying that's why the Patriots won the game. I think the Jets, when you're up 14-0 early and you're putting the pressure on the Patriots and you can't continue to do so, you know, I think the Jets have a lot of other places to look for blowing that lead and losing that game. But that is a pivotal call. I mean, you just said it. The Patriots gave up 17. It easily could have been 24. It probably should have been 24 based on that call. And I just still haven't seen one replay that would overturn the call on the field of a touchdown. I know he lost possession briefly. You got to show me where the football went out of the end zone. You got to show me where he didn't have possession for any more than, you know, a fraction of a second where he lost control. I would never call that a fumble. I would call that maybe juggling the football, which by letter of the law may perhaps be a fumble. But if nothing else, that's a rule the NFL has to change. If it's enforced properly, that's something they really have to look at, because if that's a touchback as opposed to a touchdown, then that's a bad rule.
Do you think we've gone too far with replay in not only the NFL, but in sports in general?
100%. I mean, when we are breaking that play down frame by frame to the point where they had to watch however many replays, how long was the review yesterday? I mean, it's not like it was a quick review where they looked at it and they're like, oh, okay, here we go. And I know that was Corrente's explanation yesterday. Oh, once we got this one angle, it was quick. The whole thing wasn't quick. It took forever. They had to look at it frame by frame. And I think everyone watching in real time, the only question was, is he down at the half-yard line or is it a touchdown? I mean, that's the only question I had watching it live. So, yes, I think we've gone too far. I think plays like this are an extreme example, but they're definitely an example of why, you know, scaling it back would be useful, I think, for a lot of leagues, not just the NFL.
All right, on to the X's and O's. And you mentioned the defense. Yesterday, Patriots linebackers in coverage throwing that way. The Jets were 9 of 9 completing passes for a touchdown. Meanwhile, you had Malcolm Butler blitzing multiple crucial third and fourth downs. Is Matt Patricia too eager to blitz the corners, and is this something we need to get used to?
So I'm in the process of rewatching the game as we speak. We've had some internet issues here by place, Comcast issues here by place. So I'm about halfway through the third quarter. You know, where I've left off, the blitzing actually worked out pretty well for Malcolm Butler. Maybe I need to go back and rewatch a couple of plays in the third and fourth quarter, but there was a big third down blitz where they brought Butler, or maybe it was a second down blitz where they brought Butler and rushed McCown into a throw he didn't want to make. You know, I don't know if it's blitzing corners. I don't know if it's, you know, dropping linebackers into coverage. And I know Roberts had tons of issues with Seferian Jenkins on that first drive. I know Van Noy has had plenty of issues all year long in coverage for this Patriots team. I think getting Hightower back helps, don't get me wrong. But I think Patricia has been overmatched all year long. And I don't know if that's getting too cute with the scheme. I don't know if that's the Patriots got too cute with the personnel in the offseason, but it's been a disconnect, you know, really from the jump. And I think they're spinning the wheel a little bit, trying to figure out what's going to work week to week. You know, admittedly, yesterday they were shorthanded. No Stephon Gilmore, which means Bottomosi had to play. And you know, I know that the Jets didn't make a lot of big plays on him. I wonder if that's because they didn't go after him. I was shocked they didn't go after him more. I feel like when Gilmore's out of the game and there's a special teamer in the secondary, that's the guy you want to attack. I just feel like right now they don't have a lot to go on. There's not a lot they can go to in big spots, and so Patricia's kind of searching. And that's not to absolve him of any guilt or let him off the hook, but that's been a major issue for this defense all year long. When you're giving up plays and yards like they did to the Jets, you know, not Drew Brees and the Saints, not Matt Ryan and the Falcons next week, the Jets, then that's a major, major issue for this team.
And just to follow up on something you said in terms of maybe getting cute with the scheme, I think there were three plays yesterday where Malcolm Butler or another corner was blitzing and Trey Flowers was in coverage. I guess my question is, what the hell?
Can't possibly
think that's going to work.
Well, we've seen them drop Trey Flowers quite a bit, you know, in various plays over the years where he'll bat down a pass. You know, he'll be the one who makes a play. I think the first play of the game, in fact, he either dropped into coverage or at least was kind of out in the flat and batted down a pass on the count. So, you know, I'd have to go back and double check, you know, see what was working, what was not. I guess they're trying to give quarterbacks different looks. What I would say is with McCown, why are we so worried about giving him different looks? You know, you should be able to shut down Josh McCown straight up. Again, if you need to fool Matt Ryan next week and scheme it up next week, I get it. You know, that's a quarterback who he can break things down. He can diagnose things. He can make every throw in the book. I feel like Josh McCown, you should be able to stay pretty vanilla and still make plays.
So there seems to be a personnel problem on that defense, especially Stephon Gilmore out, and there's just a lot of holes. Do you think the Patriots will make a move between now and the trade deadline? And is there a move out there to be made?
So I think they will. I don't know how significant of a move they'll make. I think we'd all love to see them make a trade similar to Aqib Talib a few years back. What was it, 2013, 2012? I don't know if that's in the cards. I would imagine that there's another transaction coming. Bill's been very active at the trade deadline, whether it was big names like Talib, whether it was guys like Akeem Hicks, Akeem Ayers, Jonathan Casillas, Ike Sopoaga is another guy they traded for at the deadline from the Eagles. Like they've been pretty active when it comes to the trade deadline. So is it going to be a big move? Is it going to be a big name? I know Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie kind of had some issues with the Giants. It sounds like those are ironed out if you were looking for cornerback help. I don't know that there's an obvious fit out there. I don't know that the Patriots are going to be that active for a big name, but I do know Bill's been sniffing around this time of year, and he's been very active. So if anyone's going to make it, it's probably him.
Well, while we're on that topic, this one came to mind for me yesterday. Would you be interested in the Patriots maybe shopping Jimmy Garoppolo to the Packers for a player such as Ahaha Clinton Dix?
So I'd be interested in them shopping Garoppolo, period. And I don't know what the return would be. I don't know what the appetite would be, you know, trading for a quarterback and blowing things up and, you know, rebuilding your offense middle of the season. And the Packers may not have much of a choice, mind you, with Rodgers out. But at least Hundley's been there for a couple of years. At least he knows the offense. You're not teaching him anything new. I mean, you're getting him reps and you're making sure that he can play. And I don't know that he can, based on the little bit I saw out of Brett Hundley yesterday. But I wouldn't be surprised if the Packers or most teams in the league right now are more comfortable with the backup that they have for this year instead of reteaching and breaking down at the quarterback position midway through the year. That said, if you could get safety help in Ha-Ha Clinton Dix for Jimmy Garoppolo, great. If you could get future draft picks for Garoppolo right now, I'd do it. If Green Bay wanted to give you future draft picks, I would do it because there's a very real possibility you're losing him at the end of the year for nothing. And the way that Brady's been playing all year long, I don't see a drop-off. I really don't. So there's still a massive question as to what they're going to do with the quarterback position long-term. I know Brady's dinged up, so maybe you're whistling past the graveyard, keeping your fingers crossed and hoping he stays healthy, but I have been of the mindset for a couple of years now. Trade Garoppolo for what you can get or what you can get out of him. And I would not expect the Patriots to do that between now and the trade deadline, but if you're asking me, that's personally what I would do.
How big is this game this week for the rest of the season? We're coming into week 7. It's one of the best offensive teams in the NFL. If they have another, you know, poor defensive outing, what will that mean for the Patriots down the stretch?
Well, I think if they have a good outing, it would tell us a lot more, right? Like, I fully expect them to get shredded. Like, I expect them to give up plays. I expect them to give up points. Now, look, it's not like Matt Ryan and that offense was very good yesterday, again, from the little bit that I saw against the Dolphins, just bouncing around on red zone and highlights and things like that. You know, I think Ryan's been picked off in just about every game this year. I think he's thrown 6 interceptions. He threw 7 all of last year. Julio Jones doesn't have a touchdown yet this year, which is staggering to think about. So maybe Atlanta's not quite what they were a year ago. I haven't sat down and watched them a ton so far in the early portion of the year, but based on the way the Patriots are giving up yards and points to most quarterbacks, certainly yards to every single quarterback, I'd expect them to get shredded. I'd expect Matt Ryan to have a bounce back kind of game. I'd expect Julio Jones to get into the end zone for the first time this year. So I think you can learn a lot more about the Patriots if they do, I don't know, maybe a similar performance to what they had yesterday, give up some yards to Matt Ryan, but keep him out of the end zone. That would be a lot more meaningful against the Falcons, holding them to call it 17, 20, 21 points somewhere in there, than it would someone like Josh McCown, who 17 points for McCown feels like 30 for most other quarterbacks.
Do you think the Patriots, and now it's 2 weeks in a row they've allowed under 20 points, do you think they're concerned with the big plays they're giving up as long as they continue to keep stopping teams from getting in the end zone?
See, I think the big plays are what Bill Belichick hates. So he can tolerate 10 yards, 15 yards, 12 yards, you know, 8 yards. If a team's going to nickel and dime them the whole way down the field, he can tolerate that. Even if it's the third downs, like the opening drive where the Jets, I think, converted 4 third downs, including a scramble from McCown, the touchdown to Safarian Jenkins on the opening drive was a third down. I think Bill can stomach that. I really do. What he can't stomach are the big plays. You know, the broken play that gets a 30-yard touchdown or whatever it was to Curley, where, you know, Malcolm Butler is going for a jump ball and taking the risk of the pick instead of making the sound play, trying to break it up, make the sound tackle, keep him short of the end zone, right? Same thing on the first drive for the Jets. Big play down the field, Curley again, right down to the 1 yard line, 30 yards or whatever it was. I think those are the plays that drive Bill nuts. So if they can nip those in the bud, the big chunk plays, I think he'll be happy. And I know he's more than content to give up yards. If you're nickel and diming your way down the field and eating up a lot of clock and putting together 8, 10, 12 play drives, he's going to tip his cap. If you're getting 30-yard chunks and 25-yard chunks and you're doing it routinely, I think that's what he hates the most about his defense, because right now they're bending and breaking in a lot of cases. I know they haven't given up a lot of points the last couple of weeks, but I think that's been the issue for the defense. They're not just giving up some yards here and there where quarterbacks are stringing drives together. They're giving up big plays, and that's really the hallmark of a Belichick defense, not to allow those.
I mean, this is how I've seen it. I'm curious if you're seeing the same thing. A lot of it just seems to be that they can't tackle. Broken tackles left and right. Nobody outside of Devin McCourty seems to want a wrap tackle. They all want a shoulder tackle. Do you think this defense would look differently if they could just cut down on the broken tackles?
I'm sure. You know, I think that's a fair criticism. You mentioned McCourty. He has been really good, and Bill singled him out before for wrapping up. I thought the Tampa game was noticeable how good McCourty tackled. Again, I'm about halfway through this game, a little more than that, so I got to see if he breaks down at all in the second half. But outside of McCourty, I do think you see some missed tackles. I just think you see too many free guys. I think you see too many free receivers, and tackling is an issue once you're trying to track them downfield, but I don't know, one of the first completions of the game to Robbie Anderson was 22, 23 yards. Malcolm Butler was way off the line, just a soft cushion, all alone. I think you get a lot of free runners, a lot of free releases against this defense, and that's something that we're not used to seeing in years past. You know, no Gilmore yesterday, I think that made it even more eye-opening because he had been one of the guys who had given up a lot of them, especially in the Carolina game. We all got on him for it. He had given up a lot of big plays, a lot of just broken plays, and they continued even without Gilmore out there. So I don't know what to make of that. Between the tackling and guys running free through the secondary, these are issues we're not used to seeing out of a typical Bill Belichick defense.
So the million-dollar question with the Chiefs losing yesterday, the Broncos got exposed, Packers losing Aaron Rodgers. Are the Patriots, through all of this, as crazy as this season has been for everybody, still the Super Bowl favorite in your eyes?
So it's hard for me to say because I've never really docked them from Super Bowl favorite in my mind, right? Like we've criticized them. We've wondered if they can keep playing like this and if they can get to the mountaintop. But I've never believed in the Chiefs. Like never, not one time have I believed in the Chiefs. And I understand if
you're preaching to the choir here.
Yeah. I mean, if Vegas wanted to make them the odds-on favorite, then that's fine. I just look at a lot of the other teams around the league, and I'm sure teams are looking at the Patriots and saying the same thing. Oh, with that defense, they'll never win, right? But I look at the Steelers. I thought they were a train wreck. I can't believe the game they pulled out yesterday against the Chiefs, from Le'Veon Bell popping off to Antonio Brown popping off to Roethlisberger wondering if he's done, to the whole national anthem thing where Mike Tomlin had the team stay in at halftime. They just seemed like a disaster. And then they turn around and they beat what had been the best team in the league. You know, so the Chiefs were exposed yesterday. I like the Raiders coming into the year. I like the Raiders last year. They're 2-4, and they're a mess. And some of it is an injury to their quarterback, but how could you possibly trust that team at this point in time? You know, you look over to the NFC like you brought up. Green Bay just lost Rodgers. We went through Atlanta earlier with all their issues. Dallas isn't the same team. I don't really look at a team that I can hang my hat on and say, boy, if the Patriots get that team on their best day, the Patriots can't beat them. I think the Chiefs have been the closest thing, and as I said earlier, I just don't believe in Kansas City. So, yeah, if you're going to tell me the Patriots are the favorite, I'm not going to disagree with you. There's no team that right now in the league I'm saying, yep, I'm picking that team against the Pats head-to-head. I pick the Patriots every week because usually they win 13, 14 games and go on a deep playoff run, and I don't believe in another team right now in today's NFL, and it's felt like that for a couple of years now.
Adam Jones, the vulture of 98.5. You always bring the positivity on our show, Adam, and we appreciate
True.
That.
I do. I try to. I want to give you guys a little bit of a glass half full take.
You can follow him on Twitter at AdamJones98.5. Adam, thanks for calling in.
Yep. As always, guys, thanks a lot.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth, Alex Lebowitz still with you. And Lebowitz, well, there's a lot going on right now. Obviously, it's still exciting. Red Sox season has come to an end. We haven't gotten a chance to talk to you since we were there last week. We saw it all come to an end. Really, just a pathetic display in Game 4 by the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah, when you have a lead like that and you blow it, it's always just, yeah, pathetic's the word. I think it was a managerial thing. We don't have to go too far into that game. But you heard me say it when Chris Sale came back in the eighth inning. I said, I don't feel good about this.
Grady Little-esque. And we'll touch on the managers a little bit. Now's the fun part. We get to pick it apart, talk about what's going to happen with the Red Sox the next couple of months. But so we're recording this on Monday, as we usually do. It's already been announced Alex Cora is the favorite. He's been interviewed. So it sounds like that decision could come down soon. Obviously, we want the show to be relevant throughout the week until we talk to you next week. So just we'll touch on the manager real quick and then move on. Who's your ideal candidate of the names that have been thrown out there?
You know, whenever you're looking at a manager, I feel like fans have unrealistic expectations. They want a guy who's going to come out and be, you know, obviously top three, top five manager and kind of prove themselves with your team. I don't think you really had that with the candidates so far. And whenever this type of thing happens, I like them to get someone who hasn't really been discovered yet. That's why I don't like names like Rod Gardenhire.
You really don't like that name.
No, I really hate it. Brad Ausmus. I don't like these guys who have managed and kind of, you know, worn out their welcome and had underwhelming managerial careers. I want them to get a guy who's a first-time manager. I know Dombrowski doesn't like that. So I like Alex Cora. I think that he'd be a decent addition. Another name, this is kind of just a selfish fan thing that I want, but I honestly think it could work, potentially. Jason Veritek, he's a guy who was an unreal clubhouse guy when he was in the league. So those are two names that I really like. Guys who have managed before, who have been fired, who have gotten canned, who we know what to expect from, I don't want anything to do with them. I want them to take a chance on someone who will be a first-time manager.
Look, last time they went after a sexy name just to try to appease the fans, it was Bobby Valentine. And I think that's the last thing we all want. Do not go PR happy, fan happy. Go get the big name out on the market because that guy generally doesn't work. Yeah, I'm fine with Cora. The name I like is Gabe Kapler just because I've heard about what a great leader and teammate he was when he was here. And that would be my preference. I'd be fine with Alex Cora. Veritek, I don't want a first-time manager. Or let me rephrase that. I don't want a first-time coach.
But he's been in the clubhouse. Like, he has coached.
He's been in the clubhouse, but I want somebody who's at least been a bench coach, a pitching coach, a hitting coach, something. I want somebody who has had some sort of coaching experience. My ideal situation is, I think, given how young this team is, the guy you're bringing in now you're not looking for a 10-year solution. You have about a 3 or 4 year window to try to win a World Series with this team. And if not, you're blowing it up, and then you're going into a longer rebuild. So give me somebody like a Cora, like a Kapler now, but put what I want with Veritek, and by the way, same goes for Pedro Martinez here, because I'm sick of Pedro Martinez teaching the Yankees players how to pitch. Pedro needs a coaching job with the Boston Red Sox. And honestly, I would take him as the manager over Veritek, because you're not screwing around in Pedro's clubhouse. That guy's a competitor. But what I want is give me Cora Kapler, whatever, some boring name for the next 3 or 4 years, but put Veritek on the staff so that when you get ready to go into that longer kind of run, Veritek is your guy. Let's get him the experience while somebody else is at the helm, and then let's set Veritek up to be the next guy. That's kind of my goal in all this. I don't really care who they hire as long as they make Veritek a part of the staff going forward, because he should be their manager at some point down the line. I just don't think he's ready yet.
I don't think in-game managerial experience is all that important.
Okay, Dave Dombrowski.
No, I mean, like, experience-wise coming into a position. Obviously, when you are the manager, that's one of the most important
it's not
aspects.
Even about the in-game stuff. It's about setting lineups. It's about handling a pitcher coming up to you after six innings and saying, I'm good to go, when you know he's not. I want him to see that, see somebody else dealing with that before he deals with it himself.
I feel like you underestimate how much players do that, how much a former catcher does that, especially. He's dealing with everything. He's dealing with the opposing pitcher. He's dealing with his own pitchers. That's a guy who knows how to prep, who's well-rounded, and he's not just a pitcher like a guy like John Farrell. From what I've seen, catchers make the best managers. And I look at Jason Veritek as someone who is a very smart player, who is very well-respected, and who has a great coach's demeanor. Is he exciting? No. Is he this sexy hire? Would he be? No. But he'd be a good manager. I truly think that. But it goes back to the Red Sox ownership wanting to hire someone who's good with the media, who's marketable. Alex Cora definitely fits that prototype.
See, I don't think he does. Who's Alex Cora to the casual fan? No, he would interact well with the media. But Bobby Valentine, everybody knows who Bobby Valentine was. Everybody knew that name for one way or another. Everybody in Boston knows who Veritek is. He is the fan-happy name, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't want to see them go that way, because it didn't work well last time. Let Veritek get some experience. All right. That will probably be sorted out by the time people listen to this.
Yes.
So we're going to move on to what actually matters, and that's the players, the personnel, what happens with this team. Not too many people you got to worry about re-signing, which is an interesting dilemma. It's more about who they're going to add. And part of that is, like I just mentioned, not too many people's contracts are up. They have a few people for sure locked in next year, including David Price, Hanley Ramirez, Rick Porcello, Dustin Pedroia, Craig Kimbrell, and Chris Sale. Most of their players are on arbitration. Really, the biggest undrafted, I did this off the air too. I see UFA, I think undrafted.
Yeah.
The biggest unrestricted free agent to me is Eduardo Nunez, maybe Doug Fister. Most of the rest of the guys to me were rentals. No, duh, they're gone. So not a lot of money to work with for the Red Sox this offseason, and that concerns me. Because this ownership has shown they don't want to go over the luxury tax, even being the Boston Red Sox. And they're going to need to spend money this offseason. This team, as it's constituted, they're like the Celtics last year. And I think I said this to you when we were walking out of Fenway last Monday. The Celtics last year, they were a very good team. They were, you could say, a borderline championship team. They were one of the final three teams left.
Yeah.
But they still didn't have the pieces to turn that core into a championship team. As good as they were, the only way to get to the next level was to blow it up. And we've seen them do that this offseason, and they are now a much better team. We talked about that earlier in the show. The Red Sox, to me, are kind of in the same spot, where if they don't win it next year, as good as they are, the only way to get over the top, given their financial restrictions, may be to blow it up and start over, whether it's with a Giancarlo Stanton, which we'll get into, a J.D. Martinez, one of those guys. I need to see them spend some money this offseason, one way or spend assets. If not money, assets, one way or the other.
Absolutely. I mean, after this season, I think most Red Sox fans can't help but question what Xander Bogaerts' future is in Boston, what Dustin Pedroia's future is in Boston, although it's going to be hard to get
rid of him. He's a 10-5 guy. Yeah, he's here. Better or worse, he's here.
They're not going to be able to get rid of him. But a guy like Bogaerts, a guy like Jackie Bradley Jr., no one knows if they're going to be on the opening day roster next season. And I think the biggest thing we've learned this season is that Xander Bogaerts has been somewhat of a bust. He's a guy who should be hitting at least .315 every year with the power numbers he puts up. He needs to compensate for that. He didn't do that. He was more around .275. That's a guy they might package away. They might send out.
I think that's absolutely a guy they should look to move in the coming months. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And you know, it's not even a talent thing with this team. That you don't blow it up because they're lacking talent. You blow it up for the same reason you fire John Farrell. There's a clubhouse problem. There's a clubhouse atmosphere problem. There's a leadership problem.
No, I think there's a lack of talent too. Not that much.
It's underperforming more than anything.
They're not as talented as Houston is. We saw that Houston is a more talented team, and that's ultimately they don't have that talent level to get by that team, and I don't think Cleveland either.
Well, I think their bullpen was more talented than Houston.
See, the bullpen to me, and you talked about seeing Chris Sale come back out for that eighth inning.
Yeah.
And they never had, and it was their Achilles heel all year. They, as great as people said their bullpen was and as good numbers as they put up a lot of those numbers. Either it was Craig Kimbrell putting up those numbers or they put them up in garbage time. They never had that eighth inning bridge guy. They never had that guy that, okay, we're going to go seventh inning, then him, then Kimbrell. And it got to the point where they felt safe keeping a tired Chris Sale on the mound. That's why they brought in Addison Reed. He was available. They didn't go to him. That Joe Kelly was supposedly that guy at one point. Matt Barnes was supposedly that guy at one point. He wasn't on the postseason roster. That, to me, is one of their biggest needs that I feel like people aren't talking about. As good as Craig Kimbrell is, you need a solid eighth inning guy. You do. And they've ignored that for years.
That's one guy that they need, though. Because
they have other needs too. But yes, that's one need.
And I don't even think they necessarily need it. I think Joe Kelly could be that guy. I think Addison Reed could be that guy. I think Carson Smith potentially could be that guy.
If you think somebody could be that guy and not is that guy, they're not that guy. That's just what that role is.
Maybe it's the Red Sox management not putting enough trust in these relief pitchers. Because I think they had that all along. I think the most overblown thing with this Red Sox team this season was the bullpen. They have a good bullpen. I'll stand by that.
It's good. It's not great.
It's not amazing. It's not the Yankees, but it's still good enough to win a World Series.
It clearly wasn't because they lost game four because they didn't have anybody to go to
because
the
they didn't
inning.
Trust the eighth inning guy. They stuck Chris Sale out there and he was in there too long.
Well, doesn't that tell you something that they have nobody they can trust?
You see, I think they could have gone to Addison Reed. I would have gone.
You
to
could
Addison
have, but
Reed.
Clearly they didn't trust him, so he's not the guy.
But that's not a talent problem. That's the Red Sox decision making.
But
that
I think they view it as a talent problem.
Yeah, and I don't think that's the correct assessment. I think there's problems on this team. And the biggest one is leadership. Is having that winning clubhouse atmosphere. And number two is power. They have zero power in that lineup. And I think those two things go hand in hand. You need a guy who will show up in clutch situations, can hit the long ball, and can lead. And
so David Ortiz.
That's the thing. Like for however much we thought that his absence would affect this team, it was 10 times more than
yes.
that. Like that's the biggest, most underplayed thing this season. The absence of David Ortiz just being a huge factor, negative factor on this team. They need someone who can do half of what he did because they didn't have that this year. Pedroia wasn't that guy. David Price tried to be that guy, and it completely tainted that locker room.
Okay, so let's get into that now because this is the real conversation I wanted to have 12 minutes into the segment. We finally get to the point I wanted to get to. Can you imagine if this was terrestrial radio? We would miss so many breaks. All right. So you just wrote down before the break, we went through the top 10 upcoming free agents according to MLB.com. We have a couple others on that list. So ignoring the pitchers now, let's go through that list and think yes or no in terms of a fit for the Reds. We can skip the pitchers. We can skip you, Darvish, Jake Arrieta. I don't see them going out spending big money on a pitcher when they have Price and they're about to pay Sale.
Okay, here's a few. Mike Moustakas.
I'm a no on that.
Eric Hosmer.
Maybe. You can give your input, too. This isn't just me. I'm no on Moustakas because I think he's a guy that made his name in the playoffs. He's not a regular season guy. They've gotten that guy before. His name is Pablo Sandoval.
Yeah.
Literally down to the nickname, Moose Panda. I'm out of Moustakas. He's not as bad as Sandoval, but I see that as being a similar situation.
I out of this list, there are other guys that I prefer.
Yes,
over
okay.
Mike
so,
and Eric Hosmer.
Yeah, Hosmer, for me, I'd be okay with him.
Yeah.
It depends on the contract. He's older. He's 30. If you're looking at a guy on just a one-year deal, at that point, I'd probably rather have Moreland, believe it or not. But, yeah, okay, keep going. Because those two, I know Hosmer's a hot name. I'm out on that one.
Now, the next two guys are two guys that I would want the Red Sox to go after. A lot of that would come down to trading assets to make room for these guys.
And we'll get into that. I want to get into the trades, too.
JD Martinez is number one.
I like Martinez. I don't think he leaves Arizona. I don't think he's going to be available. That's my biggest issue with him, is if they are planning, okay, we're going to go sign JD Martinez, you better have a plan B ready, because I don't think he's leaving what they've built in Arizona.
Yeah, what he's done has been so impressive right there. 29 home runs. Jay Bruce is another guy.
He's got Mets stank on him.
Do you think?
He just seems so Mets. And I know another guy on that list is Curtis Granderson. I'm going to give the same answer for him.
Lorenzo Cain?
Nope.
And we'll go through the list more. Melky Cabrera?
Nope. Steroid guy? Nope.
Matt Holliday?
I could see them bringing him in. Chris Young's an unrestricted free agent. I could see them bringing in Matt Holliday to fill the Chris Young role. Think about it. Playoff. And I would be okay with that.
I'd rather have Curtis Granderson.
I think I'd rather have Matt Holliday.
Curtis Granderson hit more home runs than anyone in the Red Sox roster this year. If he's your fourth outfielder, I think
for the money, because again, this team's going to want to stay under. And if there's other moves, and there's another move I have in mind, and I think everybody knows what it is, but for the money, give me Holliday. He was okay this year.
He's a good clubhouse guy too.
Great clubhouse guy, postseason experience. I would love to have him around Benintendi, Mookie. I would be in on Matt Holliday.
I don't think you're losing with either two of those guys. No. I think Curtis Granderson's a really good clubhouse guy, and Matt Holliday
is. But again, I think Granderson's, he still has a big contract left. Holliday, you're going to get value for your dollar.
Carlos Gomez.
Hit me with the other Carlos.
Carlos Gonzalez.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes. Again, it goes into that fourth outfielder. Unless you move Jackie Bradley Jr., which is, are we done? There's one more name on that list that's a pitcher that I want you to read because they are going to sign
no,
this guy.
They're not.
They need to bring in budget pitching, okay? Whether Drew Fister's back or not, they have a love affair with this guy. He's an undrafted free agent. Get ready to pull your hair out because I'll tell you this right now. Book it. Monday, October 16th, 11:16 a.m., Clay Buchholz is coming back to Boston. And we should riot, but it's going to happen.
There's another guy on this list who I think is coming to Boston before Clay Buchholz.
Who's that?
I think if you're looking for a starting pitcher for some depth, Lance Lynn. Wouldn't that be the guy?
They love Clay Buchholz.
He's a veteran, though.
They love Clay Buchholz.
He's more reliable.
I think Lance Lynn would be a great addition. I just, again, with a lot of these guys, especially pitchers, those dollars go quickly. Wade Davis was on that list. I would totally be in on Wade Davis. I think that's a guy they should
go after.
Wade
Davis would be good.
Wade Davis to Craig Kimbrell, there's your eighth inning guy, no question.
Yeah,
absolutely. They're not going to pay him.
No. And it comes back to what their priorities are. What's the biggest issue with this team? And we've already, for me at least, it's that leadership and it's that lineup. It's power. The bullpen, that's on the back burner. The starting rotation, that's on the back burner. Again, they have talent there. It comes down to getting a bat in that lineup who can hit 30 home runs for you.
And let me give you the name. And it's not 30. It's not 40. It's not 50.
It's
Giancarlo's going to hit. That's right. I think it makes too much sense for them to not go after that guy. And look, supposedly the reports are Derek Jeter is in love with Xander Bogaerts, loves his game. So you start with that. You throw Jackie Bradley Jr. in there. Jason Groom is a top five prospect. And then you absorb a lot of that contract. And that, in my mind, should be almost enough. You maybe throw in another name here or there, and people say, you can't trade Xander. We've had a revolving door at shortstop for years. You re-sign Eduardo Nunez for a year, or you bring in a guy like Zach Cozart, who I think will be affordable and is a free agent. That guy gets you through 1 or 2 years, and they have a guy named C.J. Chatham, I think, is in AA, who's going to be a legitimate. He's not going to be Xander Bogaerts at the bat, but he can make plays in the field. Xander Bogaerts can't make it. He's going to be good enough to stick in a lineup every day. You have your next shortstop ready. I think Bradley, Bogaerts, Groom, even if you have to throw in Sam Travis, those four, and you eat that contract.
Michael Chavis,
sure. You go out and you get Stanton, and then you move Benintendi to center field. I mean, that makes you the favorite to me in the American League. You can go fix the rotation with Lance Lynn, Clay Buchholz, whoever. If you make that move, and then you fill the shortstop hole with a Nunez or a Cozart, you're the favorite in the American League overnight.
And anything
less than that, look, he is available. He shouldn't be, but he is available. Mm-hmm. Jeter does not want to spend money in Miami. Anything less than Giancarlo Stanton, this is like the Celtics last year. The Red Sox, in a lot of ways, are very similar to the Celtics of last season. They have the assets. They have the capital. Go get it done. We all know it's there. It's on the table. If Stanton is moved and it's not to the Red Sox, this offseason is a failure and they need to blow it up. Because if they can't go get a guy like Stanton with the situation they have now, they need to restart because there's no other way to add that kind of talent and this team isn't winning a World Series without it.
I agree. I think the untouchables, obviously Chris Sale, Craig Kimbrell, Benintendi, Betts, and Devers. But Bogaerts, move him out. I don't care.
I do not want to see him on this team next year.
JBJ, another guy, get him out of here. He's a Boris guy. He's going to want way too much money.
I don't think he's a must trade. You're right. He's probably gone at the end of his contract, but he is somebody with value you can move.
And you're talking about an inconsistent team, that is your most inconsistent player on the most
Bradley?
Inconsistent team.
Bradley? Yes. Absolutely.
So get him out of here. I don't care. You got plenty of outfield depth if you're bringing in a guy like Giancarlo Stanton as well. So start with those two guys and throw in some prospects. As long as you don't trade Devers, Benintendi, Betts, and obviously Kimbrel and Sale, take whoever you want.
Right, pretty much, yeah. And everybody says, well, you need to give up Devers or Benintendi to get Stanton.
No, you don't.
In a normal situation, you would, but given the financial issues of the Miami Marlins, if you're willing to take, what does he make, like $200 million a year? Not $200 million a year, $20 million a year? Something like that?
Who?
Stanton.
Stanton's making more than that, I think.
Whatever it is. If you're willing to eat a lot of that contract with the Red Sox, what the Red Sox can do, that's equivalent to me to a top 10 prospect, to be able to eat that much money. Yeah. They're trying to ball on a budget down there in Miami, mm-hmm. and if you can help them do it, it's going to be very valuable to them. So I don't think they need to give up Devers or Benintendi. It would take Bogarts and Bradley and a Jason Groom and another piece, whether it be Chavis, whether it be, Travis,
Chapman.
Whoever. Fine. If you can hold on to those two guys, Benintendi and Devers,
yep.
and still and get best. Stanton. And the fact that you can realistically do that, and I genuinely believe this is realistic, there's no excuse not to pull the trigger on that. If you have a reason that they should not make that trade, please let me know. Please let me know on Twitter, at Calling It Podcast, at The Real Alex B. Let me know, because you're asinine. I know he has injury history, yeah. but he got hit in the face with a fastball. That's not injury history. That's bad luck. And even as much as he missed this year, he hit 60 home runs. He hit 60 home runs. You give that guy the green monster, and yeah. we're marching through the streets with duck boats. No question.
I think that's the guy you need. I don't know what he's like as a leader. I'm not sure.
I don't care. He had 60 home runs. But he leads by example.
He's a spark. And you have...
You know what, actually? After the Jose Fernandez thing a couple years ago, it seemed he was the guy the team rallied around.
Yeah. Him and D. Gordon, yeah.
Right. So that maybe that's a light into him as a leader. I hadn't even thought of that, but that's a good point. I'm not... If you're hitting 60 home runs...
It doesn't matter.
You can walk through the clubhouse, both middle fingers up all day, every day. I don't care.
Yeah, and he's not a problem. That's No one's ever said he's a problem.
He doesn't seem like he's a problem. If he's a leader, we don't know, but he doesn't seem like a problem. All right, we've gone way over on that segment.
Yep.
So that, I guess we don't need a fourth segment on this show. I guess we're good. We'll be back next week. I promise next week we will get to the Boston Bruins. There's a lot going on I want to complain about. 27% last night on faceoffs through two periods. The team's in trouble. We'll get into it next week. Patriots, Red Sox, Celtics as well. Follow the show on Twitter, at Calling It Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes and SoundCloud. He's Alex Lubitz. I'm Alex Barth. We'll talk to you next week. This has been Calling It. Bye.